Callie and Esau Ruffin registered to vote in 1951. Together they marched into the office of the circuit court clerk and asked to be added to the voter rolls. The deputy clerk, as she was trained to do, handed them a laminated card with the words Declaration of Independence across the top. The text was written in German. The clerk, assuming that Mr. and Mrs. Ruffin were as illiterate as most blacks in Ford County, said, "Can you read this?" "This is not English," Callie said. "It's German." "Can you read it?" the clerk asked, realizing she might have her hands full with this couple. "I can read as much of it as you can," Callie said politely. The clerk withdrew the card and handed over another. "Can you read this?" she asked. "I can," Callie said. "It's the Bill of Rights."
"What does number 8 say?"
Callie read it slowly, then said, "The 8th Amendment prohibits excessive fines and cruel punishments." At about this time, depending on whose version was being described, Esau leaned in and said, "We are property owners." He placed the deed to their home on the counter, and the deputy clerk examined it. Property ownership was not a prerequisite to voting, but it was a huge asset if you were black. Not knowing what else to do, she said,
"Fair enough. The poll tax will be $2 each."
Esau handed over the money, and with that they joined the voter rolls with 31 other blacks, none of whom were women. They never missed an election. Miss Callie had always worried because so few of her friends bothered to register and vote, but she was too busy raising 8 children to do much about it. Ford County was spared the racial unrest that was common throughout most of the state, so there was never an organized drive to register blacks. At first, I couldn't tell if she was anxious or excited. I'm not sure she knew either. The first black female voter might now become the first black juror. She had never backed away from a challenge, but she had grave moral concerns about judging another person.
"Judge not, that ye be not judged,"
she said more than once, quoting Jesus. But if everyone followed that verse of scripture, our entire judicial system would fail, wouldn't it? I asked.
"I don't know," she said, gazing away.
I had never seen Miss Callie so preoccupied. We were eating fried chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy. Esau had not made it home for lunch.
"How can I judge a man I know to be guilty?" she asked.
"First you listen to the evidence," I said. "You have an open mind. It won't be difficult."
"But you know he killed her. You all but said so in your paper."
Her brutal honesty hit hard every time. "We just reported the facts, Miss Callie. If the facts make him look guilty, then so be it." The gaps of silence were long and many that day. She was deep in thought and ate little.
"What about the death penalty?" she asked. "Will they want to put that boy in the gas chamber?"
"Yes, ma'am. It's a capital murder case."
"Who decides whether he is put to death?"
"The jury."
"Oh, my."
She was unable to eat after that. She said her blood pressure had been up since she received the jury summons. She had already been to the doctor. I helped her to the sofa in the den and took her a glass of ice water. She insisted that I finish my lunch, which I happily did in silence. Later, she rallied a bit, and we sat on the porch in the rockers talking about anything but Danny Paget and his trial. I finally hit pay dirt when I asked her about the Italian influence in her life. Over our first lunch, she had told me that she learned Italian before she learned English. 7 of her 8 children had Italian names. She needed to tell me a long story. I had absolutely nothing else to do.